Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Couple Speak Relationship Forum on Blog Talk Radio. I'm your host, Susan Lager, a psychotherapist and relationship coach at the Couple Center and Couple Speak in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, where I broadcast live each month on Wednesdays at 8:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. In tonight's 45-minute episode, The Complications of Coupling, One Man's Controversial Views, I'll be interviewing my guest, Dr. Charles Rawlings, outspoken author of the book, It Really Is That Complicated, The Myths That Exist About Male-Female Relationships, a book about his views regarding the challenges of coupling in modern times. We'll explore some of his ideas about the pitfalls related to partners' motivations and the presence of power and control as they play out in partnerships. I've really been looking forward to doing this episode, and I'm really happy to bring him on. But first, a little bit of an intro. Charles Rawlings, MD, JD, is a board-certified neurosurgeon for nearly 20 years who became a lawyer in 2002 and now specializes in medical malpractice. An adventurer, he has also led multiple Explorers Club expeditions to remote areas of the world. As an underwater photographer specializing in living mollusks, his photographs have won many international awards. He has recently published the award-winning book, Living Shells, revealing many previously unphotographed species. You can find more of him on his websites, charlesrawlings.com, that's charlesrawlings.com, and It Really Is That Complicated book.com, and on amazon.com. Now, before I bring this man of many passions on the air, a word to my listeners. If you'd like to join us live with comments or questions, just dial 1 on your phone and you'll be in line to join us live on the air. And I think we will just take questions as they come in. We'll reserve some time at various intervals. So hello, Charles. Welcome to my show.
Thank you very much, Susan. I appreciate being here. And that was a very nice introduction. I appreciate it.
Oh, good. Well, I was very struck in reading your book and your bio about how you're kind of a Renaissance man. You've done just about everything. You lived enough in one life for 5 lifetimes, and you seem to be very passionate about a number of things, and especially passionate about this subject. And I wanted to tell you, I've read your book cover to cover and very much appreciated your honesty and fearlessness about your views, even though some of them could be construed as male chauvinistic or misogynistic. I'm sure you were aware of that, although many guys would relate, you'd probably still stir up a firestorm, especially among women. I mean, I'm sure you were aware of that, right?
I am, absolutely. And I can tell you that I am far from being a misogynist. It's more throwing out there some controversial ideas and some thoughts that really intrigue me, and some of my experiences. But I am far from being a misogynist, and everyone who knows me knows that. So.
Yeah, well, I'm not calling you one. I'm just saying there are people who might think of you that way after reading your book.
Oh,
but,
absolutely.
You know,
believe me.
You're very outspoken, and you're very clear about your views. So I guess my first question would be, what were you hoping to accomplish in writing this book?
That's a very good question. It started out as sort of I hate saying personal journey. It sounds so trite these days. But it's a way to discuss with many people the relationships of today, trying to educate people as to what's really going on in a relationship. What many people do is sort of, I hate to say, stick their heads in the sand about their relationships, or they begin to sort of put up walls or hide their true feelings from themselves. And this book is, in a small way, an attempt to sort of open folks' eyes and show them what's really going on.
Okay. And I guess I'm curious, I mean, about the title, It Really Is That Complicated. Why do you feel that relationships are really that complicated?
Cutting to the chase, it's a relationship is an interaction between two human beings, and human beings are extremely complicated, and thus interactions between two people are very complicated. And I have never seen a relationship that was not complicated.
Okay. And I'm wondering if you could say something else about, you know, what you would describe as complicated in a relationship rather than just the fact of the relationship.
Sure. People bring with them into relationships many of their past foibles, their baggage, their fears, their phobias, their desires, their prejudices, and they tend to lump them all together and throw them on their partner, who, in an attempt to get them straightened out, themselves straightened out, not their partners necessarily, and all of this psychodynamic interrelationship is complicated because most partners just are going into a relationship with their own baggage. And so you have all this past psychological drama, past experiences, past prejudices. And when I say prejudices, I mean more of a script in how the person acts when they're faced with a certain scenario or a certain action. They immediately switch on to their tape or their script in an effort to relate to that particular action or scenario or scene or whatever you have it. And so you have all these two people bringing in all of these subtle and not so subtle past experiences, past prejudices, and you get to the point where this relationship is a melding of these types of interactions and types of past behaviors, and it becomes very complicated.
Okay, so, and you made a very strong point for this in the book that I think really came through, that there's a lot of baggage that people bring into their relationships. And, you know, you talk at the end about how people really need to sort of have a better sense of their own filters and their baggage and their expectations, and they have to have more self-knowledge. You know, so you make it really clear that it's not just two people in the room. There's a lot of motivations and there are a lot of expectations and wishes that are in the room. But you also take what seems to be what people in my field would call a non-systemic view of power in relationships, that the one who cares the least holds the most power. And you talk about that in terms of sex and money. And many people would agree with you, especially in areas where decisions are made unilaterally. I'm wondering if you could say more about that and where you would see power as shared in positive ways rather than you kind of described a treacherous game of bartering and leverage. And I didn't get the sense that you had an experience of relationships where the power was kind of shared. And I'm wondering, where would you see that, or do you see that as playing out in relationships?
Wow, that's multiple questions in one statement. So what I'll do is I'll start with the ending question. Where do you see a sharing of power? To me, you see a sharing of power between two people who actually know themselves and who are open-minded and tolerant of the other person. They're able to see sort of into the other person's motivations. They are able to accept the other person's motivations. They have a business partner idea about the relationship. They see a sharing of power as beneficial to both people in the relationship. It's not like one is trying to outgun the other or trying to obtain something that is merely for their own use. It's more of a, as you would say, a sharing of power to up the partnership, if you will. Instead of up the corporation, you up the partnership. You elevate the partnership by working in tandem to each other and sharing power. But that takes two people who know themselves, who are are self-confident, have really no fear, they don't have an agenda, and they're willing to work with each other's wants and dreams and support each other. And that's when you have a sharing of power.
Okay. Now, my experience working with couples is how partners also wield power in different ways. When and how to talk, making decisions, managing social and kid schedules, how and when to make love, et cetera. That's what my work is all about, how negotiation is key, compromise is key, listening to each other is key. And what I was struck by in your book is that, and this kind of gets to a later issue that I want to talk about, but I'll get into it now, how you talk a lot about openness and awareness, but you don't say a whole lot about the actual process of power sharing. I mean, you talk a lot about people bringing motivations that may be about control, and especially women as wielding control in certain ways. But you don't, in the book, talk about how you would see people as, beside being self-aware, and you make a very strong case for that, and every psychologist and person in the field of psychology would agree with you, self-awareness is critical, but you don't talk about how you would see it playing out relationally. Do you know what I'm saying?
I do. I think the primary reason I didn't go into that is, A, I wanted to make the book somewhat light, and even though it may be heavy in certain instances, I wanted to make it somewhat short, and I didn't want to make it necessarily preachy. So I didn't really go into like a blueprint as to how to share power. What I was doing was, and on the front of the book, you know, it says, in a relationship, the one who holds the power is the person who cares the least. And that has gotten many, many comments. And once someone thinks about that, they're like, you know, you're right, and maybe I should think about that. And so what I was primarily doing was just sort of trying to shock people into saying, look, guys, this relationship, there is a great deal of power struggle going on. You've got to recognize this, and maybe if you recognize it, then you're on the first step of taking it the extra mile or the extra yard or whatever you want to call it.
Okay. Now, you know, I see that playing out at times in relationships also as a couples therapist, that the person at times who has the least motivation to stay in the relationship or doesn't have as much of an emotional investment can wield power. But I've also seen how people wield power, obviously, in different ways, and that often the one who has the money has the power. Often it's the man. Or the person who maybe has stronger social connections through the family or leverage in other ways can wield power. Or the person who can be loudest or most forceful in conversations can wield the power. And I'm wondering, have you seen that playing out in your relationship or in your relationships? Or does it feel like it's usually about the one who just has the least emotional investment?
I think it's the one who has the least emotional investment. So take your example of the one who has the most power. I mean, the one who has the most money, most people would say, okay, well, you have the most power. Well, that's not true at all, because if the person, the partner that you're with has absolutely no indication or no desire to have money, or just looks at them and says, I don't care about your money. I value this way more than money, then the money has absolutely no power to them whatsoever. If they look at them and say, look, keep your money. I'm happy. I'm gratified by what I have right now. Money doesn't buy happiness. Keep your money. Mm-hmm. You have no power over me.
It has no leverage.
It has no leverage. Absolutely. So it's the person who cares the least. This person cares nothing about money. And someone who says, well, I have all the money, I have all the power, clearly cares about the money, and the other person doesn't. They don't care about the money. But, you know, that's just one example. Same thing with, say, social ties or networking. if this person says, look, I am perfectly happy doing my own thing, I'm able to take care of myself, I don't need your network, I don't need your friends, then this person who is of such great social stature has no power. It's like, you know, obviously you're egomaniacal, you want all these connections, go at it. I don't need it, so you have no power over me. If you tell me you're not going to introduce me to the mayor, I could care less. Go introduce yourself.
Well, you know, I agree with you in one way, but not in another. What I see is that the person who holds a kind of currency that the other one values wields power. So, for instance, if one often the woman in a relationship, well, this may sound sexist because it does go both ways, but if the woman really values conversation and talking and processing of feelings, and the man is withholding in that way, he may care very deeply about her. He may care equally, but he doesn't have skills about how to talk, or he's just afraid about talking. He wasn't enculturated to talking. He never learned. Then he holds a kind of currency that the wife values, and he can wield power by his not talking. Because he can end up controlling whether there are conversations or not about things. Do you know what I'm saying? It sounds describing currency of a different kind.
Yeah, but you just made my point, because the woman cares the most about the conversation, and this other guy, the guy, may not care as much about the conversation, and so he holds the power.
Yeah, well, but that's where I disagree with you, that what I see is that often you know, somebody may care a lot, but they just don't have skills, or they're and this gets back to your initial point about know yourself. They don't have skills, or they have fear that's blocking them up, and they care desperately, but they don't know how to talk, or they don't know how to negotiate, and they care deeply about the power, but their lack of relationship skills really can get in the way. So, you know, that's where I guess I differ with you, and I would see some people as differing with you, and I see it playing out really differently in my work with couples. Now, so we don't beat that point to death.
But I mean, my other point about that is, if this person who lacks these skills or lacks this knowledge actually understands and knows that this is important to their partner, would then make efforts to learn to have this skill, or meet this other person halfway, or say, look, I'm trying, I understand it's important to you, I'm not going to wield this power over you. And that's where it comes down to, A, like what you said, knowing yourself, but then B, being able to get yourself invested in the partnership. If you know you don't talk, or you can't communicate well, and your partner holds that in high esteem, go learn how to communicate. Go take a course. Show your partner you're willing to work with them.
Yeah, so it involves your other point that you make at the and near the end of the book about be fearless, be bold, dare greatly, try new things, know your filters, really move beyond your experience of limitations. Now, I don't want to hog the air. We do have a question, so I would like to bring this listener on, if you're okay with that, all right?
Sure, no problem.
Hello, listener. Your area code starting with a 9. Welcome to the air.
Oh, hello, Susan. Thank you very much. Very interesting conversation. I had a quick question for Dr. Rawlings. You did say, Dr. Rawlings, that power shared in a positive way is between people who know them, is where someone knows themselves, they don't have an agenda, they're very confident. I think those are some of the adjectives you used, but when I heard you say that, I'm thinking, how many people really know themselves? How many people don't have their own self-agenda? Because we all have big egos. We're all human beings. We're very ego-driven. What do you say to those people? How do they work out as a relationship so that it's equally shared power?
That's an excellent question, basically, because I totally agree with you. When Susan asked me, you know, talk about couples who can share power, I think they are extremely few and far between. how, and that basically breaks down to how do you work on yourself? How do you become, how do you know yourself? How do you know what your filters are? And it takes not necessarily counseling, but at least working through it with your partner, working through it with yourself, and discussion, open, honest discussion with the other person. And that means basically having no fear to say, look, you said this, I feel like you're using this as a power play. I feel uncomfortable. I don't like this. Let's see what we can do about it. But I agree with you. I think it's very few and far between, and there's almost no one that comes in without an agenda or without some sort of a power play. Absolutely.
So what's the good news?
Well, the good news is that if you start thinking about it and one of the two people in the relationship will discuss it, then it's out in the open. It's like you've torn off the cover or thrown away the blanket, and there it is in full view, and you talk about it, and you work on it. And
so you're saying you really have to work, I would say in any relationship, I don't know if Susan would agree, and you would agree that in any relationship, you always have to be looking at yourself and always have to be working on yourself, developing yourself.
Absolutely. Yeah, that is a never-ending
That's a given.
Process.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you, caller. Now, I'm going to need to take a very brief commercial break. And this is a bit of a mental switch from our subject matter, but there's still time to sign up for my August 30th couples retreat on Star Island, New Hampshire. Spend 3.5 days on this magical island learning to expand your communication skills, speaking of communication, increase connection and intimacy, and reduce conflict in your relationship. Limited to 6 committed couples, it will be an intimate experience, once again, facilitated by me and my colleague, Meredith Richardson, a lawyer, mediator, and highly sought conflict coach in New England. Last year's retreat was a wild success, so don't miss out on an opportunity to enrich your most important partnership. For more information or to sign up, go to starisland.org. You know, there's an example, Charles, of part of what you're saying that we're agreeing on, that if you want to develop skills and know yourself better, that you need to make use of certain resources like this. And now back to our program. If you've just tuned in, I've been talking with my guest, Dr. Charles Rawlings, author of the book, It Really Is That Complicated, about his views regarding the power dynamics in relationships. Now, my next question, Charles, in your book, you talk about women wanting, quote, security, children, and the nest, end quote. Also that they want what they cannot have, quote, bad boys, assholes, end quote. Some might see this as a kind of chauvinistic, one-dimensional, pathologized view of women as neurotic, mercenary connivers and manipulators. I'm wondering, how do you explain this view in 2015?
I would disagree in terms of most of those adjectives. I think that most women, when it boils down to it, do have those sort of innate drives. They have that inside of them. In terms of wanting these bad boys, it's basically you don't know, the female or the woman isn't sure exactly what she does want. She thinks, or she's told herself, or more importantly, society has told them that she should get married, should have kids, should have this nice guy, and maybe she doesn't want that, but she doesn't want to really tell herself that. And so she goes after these bad boys who, quote, treat her poorly, don't text, don't call, don't pay for the date, whatever the case may be, just because she's just not ready for these, quote, nice guys that want to settle down and have a real relationship. On the flip side, it's very possible that these women have a much deeper problem. They have self-esteem issues in terms of they don't see themselves as being, and I hate to use the word worthy, of having some guy who loves them. It's like There's got to be some flaw with him if he loves me, because I'm certainly flawed and I just don't deserve him. There's all sorts of reasons for that particular behavior, but those are the two main ones. But it doesn't have anything to do with chauvinistic thoughts.
Okay. Well, you know, part of what I wondered, you were talking in the book, you spent a lot of time talking about dating and a lot of the treachery involved and the motives involved in dating and the pitfalls and things to watch out for. And I was struck by, how your social and obvious financial status may have influenced the women. Obviously, this is an occupational hazard charge, Charles. You know, I ask a lot of questions. I get really curious, so bear with me here. But I was struck by these dates that you took women on that would set up these, try to wow women with exotic, over-the-top dates. And I was wondering if you think that maybe your filter, you've been very influenced by, if you think your social and obvious financial status may have influenced the women you chose, who chose you, and their motives, so that maybe you saw women who couldn't, you would lean very far forward, taking them on these like over the top dates, and that maybe your financial prerogative set you up to do that, trying to wow women with these exotic experiences, and maybe setting up ridiculous expectations.
I think that is certainly one way to look at it. From my standpoint, it's not that I was trying to, quote, wow these women. I wanted to have an unusual experience myself. And so it was as much keeping me happy and going on these dates as the women. If you were to, say, go out and go on an African safari, I've done that plenty of times alone, or diving, or something like that. And so it's more of a natural type experience for me to do and just bring and use it as a date than it is to try and impress the women. Believe me, there were plenty of women who could not handle or didn't want to become involved in such an intense experience that they just didn't have any type of interest in it. Basically, they were scared, to put it bluntly. Mm-hmm. So it was as much trying to keep me entertained as it was, and I wouldn't say impressing the other women, but was trying to interest them.
Okay.
I mean, I think that's a fair enough question. Absolutely.
Yeah. And you know, I wondered how it's colored your experiences, because it sounds like you've worked so hard to be so generous and provide such intense experiences. And, you know, it made me wonder if in some way you were doing what we call leaning too far forward, overgiving, overextending, and then maybe somehow ironically conveying to women that they didn't have to do much work in the relationship. Do you know what I'm saying? That you were going to just supply them with all these experiences and everything that was so so exotic and over the top. And I know in my work, I encourage people not to lean too far forward, to expect reciprocity in relationships. And what maybe you refer to as women, you know, women want men who are bad boys or don't care that much or who end up rejecting them, is that women want men who seem confident, who aren't willing to go to the moon for them, men who kind of expect reciprocity and are centered in that way. So I know it's an occupational hazard. I can't help myself. So it was just a thought as I read it. And I wondered how your dating experience would be different if you went on some more just regular dates.
I think that's a very fair question. A regular date, probably, if you're looking at it from my standpoint, after a couple of them, probably would bore me to death. And in terms of women, if you ask one of my girlfriends as we are climbing up this jungle ridge to see the gorillas, if I was mollycoddling her, I think you definitely get a different a different statement from her. Just because the adventures, the dates, or whatever you want to call them, weren't necessarily over the top in terms of extravagantly taking care of them. It was just more of a thrill and an interest. Let's put it that way.
Okay, so for you, it sounds like it feels more like knowing that you require a high level of stimulation and excitement.
Exactly.
And kind of taking care of yourself in that way also.
Absolutely, yeah. But, I mean, and I can tell you, I mean, there's absolutely nothing wrong with, like, going out to a dinner and a movie. And while I was dating particularly the woman that I talk about in the book, we did that frequently. But that gets, I don't want to say, well, I will say boring, but it's something that also needs to be spiced up. You just can't go to a dinner and a movie. So
yeah, and that's where I would agree with you, because I regularly, and I'm supported by neuroscience in this fact, I regularly encourage couples to introduce novelty into their relationships. Novelty ramps up bonding chemicals in people's brains, and it keeps a relationship fresh, a sense of discovery and adventure. I guess my concern for you, in the dating experience was that you may unwittingly set these expectations that ultimately, it's sort of setting a woman up to feel like, she's going to be treated and she's going to have all the stuff lavished on her. And I wondered, how that might set up a kind of unevenness in the relationship. That's all. Bites you in the butt.
Yeah, no, that's fair enough. But it really wasn't that type of relationship. It was more, but believe me, the women that I've been with, they come up with as many ideas as I do. So it's like, okay, let's go do that. That sounds like a fun thing.
Okay. Now, you refer to the, quote, psychodynamic horrors of marriage. I love that. I love that expression. I'm sure you've gotten a lot of flack for it, but a lot of feedback in many ways, where sex is used as a weapon, familiarity breeds contempt, ennui, etc. And your frame seems to be all about control, manipulation, and misery. And I was wondering, as I was reading the book, Charles, why bother to ever get married, especially as you view all women as essentially the same in the way they operate, and the inevitable script between men and women as kind of unchangeable, that the script is predictable, you can foresee it. So I wondered, are you like a hopeless romantic, or why would you ever bother to get married if you see this as the underlying kind of subtext?
I would definitely call myself a romantic. There's no question about that. I think I would also be a pragmatist. I think society places a great burden on people to get married. I think many people who marry have absolutely no clue what it entails, have absolutely no clue how to make it work, have absolutely no clue how to even be in a partnership. They bring in what we've talked about before, all of their past experiences, their baggage. They see this as an opportunity to be fixed by someone else. And the marriage just isn't going to work. I mean, if you look at our divorce rate, that pretty much says that. If you can go into a relationship with a person who has the idea that this is a partnership, almost like a business partnership, you have each other's back, you know each other, you know yourself, then yeah, I think marriage is a great way to do it. But I think a lot of times society says you got to get married, and most people just aren't ready for marriage and may never be ready, just to be honest with you.
Okay. So there are kind of these, it feels to me like there, you are saying know yourself and try to communicate to each other these things so that it's a conversation. But in some levels, it felt to me reading the book like a disconnect that, women is having these, that you can kind of categorize women as wanting security, nest, real estate, children, want what they cannot have, but somehow if you could just talk to each other and be open with yourselves and each other, it will work out better. So I had a little trouble reconciling those two, but we do have another question I'd like our listeners and our callers in to be able to ask. So let me bring somebody else on the air. Hello, caller. Your area code starts with a 6. Welcome to the program.
Hello. My name is Tom. I'm finding that there is no conversation about love. That the conversation is about marriage is about a corporate relationship. I've been married 3 times, the last one being several decades, and there's a difference between the first and the last. Yes, sometimes we do enter marriage with a certain innocence about the difficulties, but you know, Dr. Rollins, have you ever been in a relationship for a long period of time?
And have
So have you experienced the gratitude of being in a relationship for a long time, the love and the, you know, existence outside of like a corporate partnership, the excitement of understanding that only the peak exists? I mean, there's always something new on the horizon, and that is part of the beauty of a relationship, not necessarily simply the cooperation on a corporate level.
Okay, fair enough. Was there a question in there that I missed?
I think so.
Yeah, I understand. I understand what you're saying. The question is, where does love play a role in a relationship outside of a corporate understanding?
Well, I think love is probably one of the underpinnings of any type of relationship. But love by in and of itself is certainly not enough, particularly in this modern day where you've got sound bites for 30 seconds and people don't pay any attention to each other and are mostly involved with themselves. I think you need to set up a relationship far and away above love. Love in and of itself just doesn't cut it these days.
Well, I understand your perspective. I certainly don't agree with it.
Fair enough. I got you.
Okay. Well, thank you. Thank you, caller. I'm sure there would be a lot of people reading Dr. Rowling's book who would probably agree with you and others who would disagree with you. It's a controversial book. Now, Charles, you make a strong point for hopefulness at the end, as related to individual growth. You're very vocal about that. And quote, once you are more sure of yourself, your partnership will become more fulfilling. By understanding ourselves and having no fear, we free ourselves to see people in a new light. Be bold, fearless, dare greatly, know your filters, end quote. You obviously understand the importance the field of psychology places on self-knowledge as a springboard for any change. But, in the book, you also say, quote, you cannot go back. A couple must be prepared to begin anew. So I was wondering, where would you see hope for a couple to change collaboratively, to expand and grow together, but mostly together to heal from the past, which is what my work with couples is all about?
I would probably say that, just like I talk about in the book, you can't go back, so you can't really, what I'm talking about there is you can't bring up all the past injuries, all the past hurts, you know, saying, well, 6 months ago you said this. Well, that's because 8 months and 3 days ago you did that. What I'm talking about in the book is essentially starting anew. You start from okay, this is day one. No one's going to talk about what each other did to each other in the past. That's gone. That's done. You can't go back. What we're going to start now is we're going to start learning each other. We're going to start respecting each other. We're not going to be disrespecting each other out in public. We're not going to disrespect each other in private. We're going to talk about sharing the power, on and on and on. And that's what I mean about not being able to go back.
Yeah, well, you know, I have a lot of trouble with that view because I do, and there are probably a lot of men who would agree with you. I hear a lot of men saying, stop bringing up the past. Why do you keep bringing up the past? Get over it. We're here now. And in my experience working with couples, the past keeps rearing its head because there hasn't been sufficient acknowledgement of injuries. There haven't been proper apologies. There hasn't been anything that feels like empathy or amending behaviors. So people develop this, it's kind of like a reservoir, a very deep reservoir of resentments and hurts and injuries. And I can tell you that in my experience, whenever somebody says that, forget the past, they're screwed. They're screwed. And it's not a good prognosis for the future. Now, I agree with you in the sense that if you drown in the past and you're always talking at the about the past and you never focus on, all right, what can we learn from the past? What do we need to do differently now? If you, you know, you're stuck in the past, that's equally as detrimental for a relationship. But I think one of the issues that I had with the book is that there's no language around apology, acknowledgement, ownership, and attending to each other's hurts and wounds. And you present this frame that would say, like, well, we can both sort of develop amnesia and turn off the whole part of our brain that has logged injuries and all that stuff and pretend that today is just a brand new day. And that's really problematic in my view, because it doesn't happen. I do not see people able to just switch it off and say, okay, even though you lied to me and you cheated, you had affairs, you spent money, you controlled me, you insulted me, I'm going to pretend that that never happened. Today's a new day. Let's behave respectfully. And I guess I'm wondering, how would you reconcile those two?
Well, I think I probably would just say you helped make part of my case in terms of people bringing into a relationship their baggage and their hurts, and you don't want to forgive me or you don't want to fix me or that sort of stuff. What I would say is basically that the present is the present and the past is the past. And if the person needed an apology or some sort of acknowledgement that, yes, okay, in the past we did this, let's learn from it. Let's not do that in the future and go forward like that. I just don't think that it's healthy and to dwell in the past. And just like you said, you can't wallow in it and perhaps acknowledge it, but you cannot sit there and rehash it. And I'm not necessarily talking about affairs or anything else like that. But if you're going to keep the relationship and you want this partner, then the affair or whoever or whatever the hurt was has passed. And I don't want to say you get over it, but it's like, okay, you acknowledge it, you say it's done, we're going to go forward. And if you can't go forward and you're still stuck in the backward area of, okay, you hurt me, there's this affair, then the relationship is doomed.
Well, I guess that's where we will always disagree, because in my experience, people learn. People, if they process the past together and they each take ownership, and that speaks not doing tit for tat, but each taking ownership about how together we created this problem and together we need to create solutions. So what together can we learn from how we behave badly? That, in my experience working with couples, is the key to living more fully in the present. So maybe we'll always disagree about that. That's okay.
No, but I mean, I would totally agree with what you just said. It's like, okay, we can process it, we can discuss it, but then we've got to get over it and move forward. You can't just sit there. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah,
I'm not saying necessarily don't acknowledge it, but I'm just saying you can't sit there and rehash it.
Well, no, you can't wallow in it. You can't wallow in it, but it needs to be paid in terms of who experienced what and how and what can we learn from it. Anyway, Charles, I can't believe it, but our time is up. I want to thank you for your honesty and sharing. And anybody who's interested in getting the book can go to itreallyisthatcomplicated.com or itreallyisthatcomplicatedbook.com. Which is it?
It really is thatcomplicatedbook.com.
Okay, I thought so. It was a typo on my error. And then also to contact Dr. Rawlings, go to charlesrawlings.com, and you'll see that he's a man of many talents and many interests. I mean, really, very passionate about life, which you could teach us all something about that. You may not agree with him, but, you know, you certainly will get an example of one person's ideas about living life more fully. So thank you very much, Charles. Thanks for being on the show.
Thanks, and I appreciate it.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Thanks for coming on. Thank you to our listeners and our callers. And if you tuned in late and you didn't hear the whole episode, you can go to my show page, blogtalkradio.com/Susan Lager, to hear the whole episode. Now, my next episode will be on Wednesday, August 26th at 8:30 p.m. I'll be hosting radio talk show host Patty Porter, the Texas conflict coach. I'm very big into Southerners these days, I guess, discussing relationships in the workplace. It should be a terrific episode, so tune in. Good night, everyone, and good night, Charles. Thank you again for being on.
Thank you for having me. It was fun.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.